Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is producer Lan Lee, welcoming you to today's Blue Barrel Conversation distributed through NBN. If you want to catch all of our episodes, you can search for the Blue Barrel Podcast, that's Blue the color, B-E-R-Y-L, or find all of our episodes on piercesalguero.com. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the Blue Barrel, a podcast for intelligent conversations about Buddhism, Asian medicine, and embodied spirituality. I'm your host, Dr. Pierce Salguero, a professor of Asian studies and medical humanities at Penn State's Abington College outside of Philadelphia. Today, I sit down with Venerable Surakulame Pemaratana, chief abbot at the Pittsburgh Buddhist Center and a scholar of modern Buddhism in Sri Lanka. We talk about his path to becoming a monk and how he found himself in a PhD program in the United States. More importantly, we talk about his role in adapting Buddhist practices to address social and mental health needs during COVID. We also compare Buddhist responses to COVID in Pittsburgh and Sri Lanka. Enjoy the conversation. And if you want to hear more from experts on Buddhist medicine and related topics, subscribe to Blue Barrel for monthly episodes.
Thank you for this invitation. Yeah.
Well, it's my pleasure. Really, when I was thinking about having this podcast and dedicating the first season to Buddhism and medicine, I thought about you because you last year came to Abington College and gave a great lecture to my undergraduate students about the Buddhist responses to COVID in Sri Lanka, based on your research. And so you were top on my mind when it came to thinking about guests to have on here to share with us your knowledge and your experience. So I really appreciate you being here. Thank you very much.
No problem. Yeah.
So would you mind just introducing yourself, just a couple lines about who you are and what you're doing these days so that our listeners know who they're listening to?
So I am Surakulame Pemaratana, and I'm a Buddhist monk originally from Sri Lanka, but I live in Pittsburgh Buddhist Center in Pennsylvania. And I have been living in the U.S. since 2008. And I'm also the chief abbot in this temple. And I have been teaching and counseling different groups of people who are attached to this Buddhist center. At the same time, also doing my academic research on the contemporary Buddhist practice in Sri Lanka. I taught as a part-time faculty at the University of Pittsburgh, and then I got my postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania, so which I completed at the beginning of this year. And then, since then, I'm working more with my on my book.
Oh, is this based on your dissertation?
Originally based on my dissertation, but it has changed its focus now. Yeah, In my dissertation work, I focused on the modernization of Buddhism in Sri Lanka, how Buddhism was modernized during colonial and also the post-colonial period in the process of globalization and all kind of changes. So my advisor at the University of Pittsburgh recommended me to focus on the Buddhist practice. And because I was trained as a in my undergraduate studies and also my master's studies to study more philosophy and more doctrines. But then after I started my PhD program at the University of Pittsburgh, I had to focus on practice and more like a historical perspective. So when I focused on modernization of Buddhism in Sri Lanka, it took me a while to recognize that there's a new way. One of the efforts that was made by the early Buddhist leaders and then also later many other Buddhist groups is to promote the veneration of the Buddha, or ritual of veneration of the Buddha as a part of emerging Buddhist identity. So my dissertation was about how the simple act of venerating the Buddha was formalized and also was reinterpreted as a mark of Buddhist identity in the late 19th and early 20th century, and how it was promoted among the Buddhist population as a practice that one should do as a Buddhist. So if you are a Buddhist, you have to venerate the Buddha, not only at the temples, but also at home. So I found early printed liturgical booklets in the archives in Sri Lanka. That is why I noticed a kind of movement that happened during the colonial period to promote the veneration of the Buddha through these printed booklets. And then I traced that movement from early 20th century all the way to the modern period, and then how it was promoted in different places, in homes, in public schools, and of course in public spaces and also even the workplaces. So my dissertation is tracing the utilization of this ritual practice as a way to assert the Buddhist identity and also as a way to like maintain the Buddhist identity amidst all kind of changes happening in this larger society.
Yeah, great. So you are a Theravada Buddhist monk. I think our listeners will be curious to hear how you became a monk.
Yes, this is one common question that I get most of the time. And so I became a monk when I was quite young. And actually, I became a novice monk when I was 10 years old. I had a distant grand uncle who was a very religious person. He inspired me to like commit to Buddhist practice. And he also kind of encouraged me. So, and then I also liked the temple environment. Whenever I visit a temple with my parents, and I like the peace and also the neat arrangement in the temple, and so I developed this desire to become a monk and be in the temple. So I was close to 10 years old by that time, and I kept asking from my parents that I want to become a monk, but I was the first child in the family. I had only one brother and one sister. And my father, my mother, especially my mother, didn't like that idea. But my desire was very strong. And then I really liked to be in the temple. And then I started to threaten my parents that I will stop going to school if they didn't let me go to the temple to become a monk. But then I informed my grandparents about my desire. And they were very supportive of my idea, because although my parents didn't like it, but if someone becomes a monk, it is an honor to the family. So my grandparents really liked it, and then they encouraged and influenced my parents to give their permission for me to become a monk. So after a few months of struggle, they finally decided that they will let me go. So they actually brought me to that grand uncle that I was talking about, and he decided to which temple that I should be sent to. So I was sent to a little bit far away monastery. It's a training monastery where I met my master. And then I was ordained as a novice monk there at the age of 10. Then I started my monastic training and monastic education right there. Of course, you know, the time when I became a monk, I didn't know anything about monkhood. I just had this desire. I liked the temple, but I didn't really know what monkhood entails. Nothing, but just a desire. But then, of course, you know, when after I went to monastery and when I started to follow the timetable, and I realized that it's not that easy. It was challenging. And I remember sometime I even cried. And I remember I kept missing my mom, missing my family, everything, and my friends also in the school. But it was not strong enough for me to like give up the idea of becoming a monk. But then soon I developed a new friendship with also other few candidates, a few boys who were training to become a monk. So I studied and did the chanting, meditation, and then, of course, studying and memorizing the text, and then doing all other monastic duties, like all kind of chores. So when I reached at the age 20, then we have to make a decision whether we want to go through the higher ordination ceremony, in which you become a full monk, or you want to return to your normal life. So by the age 20, I have developed a different appreciation of monkhood. And then, so at that age, I decided to stay as a monk. So I went through the high ordination ceremony and became a full monk.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. You said you came to the United States. And what was the occasion for you moving here?
During my monastic education, my master encouraged me to study English. It is not very common because monastic education does not place much emphasis on English. It's on Pali, Sanskrit, and the Tripitaka, you know, the Buddhist text. Of course, you also learn other secular subjects too. But my master encouraged me to study English. He supported me. He gave me tutors. So I was good at English during that time. And after I finished my monastic degree, and then I was able to enroll to a university in Sri Lanka, University of Peradeniya, where I did a bachelor's degree in Buddhist studies. And after that, my master encouraged me to do my postgraduate studies. So then I went to Thailand and to Singapore to do my master's. And then the group of people here in Pennsylvania, immigrants from Sri Lanka, so they wanted a Buddhist temple. So they formed an association, they acquired a land and small house. So they wanted to start a Buddhist center, but they were looking for a monk who can speak English. And I had no plan to come to US. I had no plan. You know, I wanted to do my PhD, my doctorate, because that is my master's, you know, vision. And he wanted me to finish my studies. So I was thinking about maybe I will go back to Singapore, maybe I'll go back to some part of the Asia. And I even thought about Australia, but I had no idea to come to the US. It's too far for me, almost other side of the globe. Right? So when they invited me, I said, no, I'm fully occupied here, I can't come. But for some reason, they kept calling me. You know, about once a month, they will call me and reminded me, can you come, have you changed your idea? So then I thought maybe I'll come for a short while. Because I'm not sure what is the situation here. So I informed the university that, you know, because I was just teaching as a visiting lecturer. So I finished my semester. I told my master that I would like to go and see, you know, what these people are doing. So I came for a short period, 3 months period. And then actually I realized that actually this community is quite genuine. They really want to learn and practice. And they also want a Buddhist center, not only for the Sri Lankan immigrants, they want a Buddhist center for the larger community here. So that, I mean, their interest and their dedication really touched me. You know, I thought that maybe this will be a good role for me to play also. And then I also visited the universities in this area and was looking for an opportunity whether I can continue my studies. So I found that actually I can do that too. So I went back and informed my master, you know, the opportunity and then also the service that I can do here. So he gave me the permission. So I came to serve them. And at the same time, I also, after a year, I also started my doctorate program too.
Yeah, thank you for telling us that story. So your research involves studying the modernization of Buddhism in Sri Lanka, and You learned Buddhist studies both in monastic colleges in Asia and then also in this more secular Buddhist studies orientation that we have here in the U.S. And so I'm wondering if there's any kind of tensions or any kinds of conflicts that you found when you started taking your doctoral courses here in the States. I'm curious about that because we've had on the podcast a number of different people who are both scholars and practitioners of Buddhism, and that's a common theme that they talk about is this a struggle to integrate the scholarship and the practice and finding that they can't really actually fully be themselves in scholarly settings.
I didn't really find any major conflict because I was exposed to this academic and more critical and historical approach to, you know, Buddhism, even in Sri Lanka when I was studying at the university there. But even at the University of Peradeniya and also at the National University of Singapore, I was focusing more on the Buddhist philosophy. So I was, my area was epistemology, you know, how, you know, philosophies, Indian philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, and in Western philosophies, how they talk about, you know, how the knowledge is constructed. But after I came here in the religious studies, you focus more on historical approach and more on actual practice. So the questions that we ask, and then also the critical and historical perspective we adopted in the university, in the graduate program, it was more on the Buddhist practice rather than the Buddhist doctrines, and more on history. So I was really enjoying that. And of course, I was also benefited to learn about other religions and also like the theories of studying religion. And it gave me a new perspective, definitely, you know, what you call looking at the religion as an outsider. And I enjoyed that, to really see even how the Buddhist tradition how Buddhist tradition have responded to different historical circumstances, and how the Buddhist communities have tried to like adapt to different situation. It was really fascinating story for me. And then also I was teaching at my Buddhist center, you know, I was studying the history of Buddhism and also the sociology of Buddhism at the university. So it gave me two different perspectives, but I think I enjoyed it. When I was at university, I was like looking at the religion from far, far, far away. So I have a different image, different Buddhism. So, and when I'm at the Buddhist center, I'm teaching more on the insight, the philosophy.
You feel like they're complementary.
They're complementary. Exactly. Even I was able to like be critical about my own practice and even the kind of Buddhist rituals that I perform for the people here. I was able to perform those rituals, but at the same time, I was able to like reflect on these rituals, what this and how this ritual has evolved, and how they are still evolving, and then, you know, how these rituals are used as tools, maybe as devices, as supporting devices, to help people to deal with difficult issues in their lives. So I was able to like see the utility of the Buddhist rituals and ceremonies in a more psychological and sociological manner.
Thank you. So let's transition to the main reason that I wanted to talk to you on the podcast. And that is because I wanted to speak with you about COVID and about the pandemic. I guess the first question I would have for you is, as a Buddhist monk living in a monastic setting, how was your personal experience or the experience of your community over the last couple of years?
Oh, at the beginning of the pandemic, it was really a challenging period. Definitely, as a Buddhist monk here, and we had to change a lot of things because people used to come to our Buddhist center. We used to gather, you know, once a week, and we used to have classes for children. People used to come for all the rituals and in all the counselings. So all this has to be changed. And so actually, what really happened was that we were inventing our practices. We started a lot of online programs. And during that time, this is before the vaccines. And then people were quite afraid also. So they have fear, they have uncertainty. So they really needed help, but they can't come to the temple. we started online programs. We started some discussions over YouTube and over Zoom. And then we also started chanting programs, and which people really appreciated. So they can join our chanting from home. So we had weekly chanting, more like a really blessing chanting and wishing people a strong immunity, a strong mind, a strong body. So people enjoyed it. So we did that. Fortunately, we also had an outdoor Buddha statue in our Buddhist center. Other than the main Buddha statue in the meditation hall, we had the outdoor Buddha statue inside the gazebo. So that was real, real useful during pandemic, because then the people who really wanted to come, they can come. So we meet people outdoors. They didn't come inside the temple. So we had some tents in front of that Buddha statue. So we did offerings, we did chanting, we did transference of merits. So we were able to do all the different kinds of Buddhist practices and venerations of the Buddha using the outdoor Buddha statue. Yeah, and even after a while, we first stopped our meditation and made it online. But then after many months, people still would like to come to the temple. So we did outdoor meditation, fortunately, during summer. So in front of that statue, we had people sitting far away from each other. And we had a nice lawn there. And so people were meditating outdoor in the evening under the candle lights. And it was a nice experience. So we had to kind of invent new programs. We used to do birthday ceremonies for people whenever they're having birthdays. So if they come to the temple, we will like to do a small chanting and a small blessing service to them. But during pandemics, we couldn't do that. So instead, what we did was actually, we recorded a blessing chant for birthdays. And then we uploaded that into YouTube. And then we created a QR code of that video link. And then we created birthday cards with our wishes and stick that QR code in the card. So it was a challenge, but at the same time, it was also an opportunity for us to rethink how we conduct our programs. And then one important thing happened actually during that time, because parents started to complain, inform us about the stress of children. Sometimes they couldn't go to school, and even when they started online classes, they don't really meet their friends. So the children were going through a lot of stress. So our parents wanted us to start some program for children. So we started a children's meditation program, which is not only meditation, but more discussion and also a yoga practice and also meditation. So we started a Sunday children's meditation over Zoom during that time. And we created a program that children can interact with, children can enjoy, children can learn the meditation and some techniques to deal with their difficult issues, how to think about their issues differently. So it was really well received. And even up to now, we still continue our children's meditation. Many of the programs we started during pandemic period has discontinued, but the children's meditation program is still running. Children is still joining us from all different states on Sundays to join our meditation program. And one other thing we did actually during this pandemic, people were isolated, right? It's social isolation. So, but we didn't want people to feel really isolated mentally. So we tried to do different programs during that time. For example, during Christmas, we used to have a Christmas lunch, gather and eat together. So, but because we can't gather, but we did, monks, we cook food for the people. We prepared packets so they can come and collect their packets. And then at the same time, once a month, we used to have monthly gathering. But once a month, we will organize some program and we will post them some kind of card, some kind of souvenir, some kind of thing that they can use it during the monthly program over Zoom. So we had some volunteers who prepared some craft work. For example, during Valentine, the time we created a nice heart and the both the leaf, and we post that to people so they can have it. So during the program, they can use it. So we did all kinds of things to keep people engaged and involved and make sure that they are not feel isolated or alone during this period.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of very thoughtful development of programs and so forth that you did during that time. I'm curious about the ritual practices you mentioned earlier, the chanting and the outdoor gazebo and so forth. And I'm wondering, were there specific types of rituals or specific types of chanting that you did during that time that were different than what you would normally do, specifically for helping people with healing or helping to protect against the illness?
Yes, actually. So, yeah, definitely we did chanting of specific sutras, because we have a lot of Buddhist sutras and there are certain sutras that are chanted for specific purposes. And similar to what happened in Sri Lanka, we also chanted a Buddhist discourse called Ratana Sutta. The Ratana Sutta is a special discourse in the Buddhist tradition. This particular sutra was given by the Buddha in a time of epidemic in India during that time. So the monks in Sri Lanka were chanting that sutra a lot. And we also did chant that sutra here. But we also chanted some other sutra. There are also a set of sutras called Bhojanga Sutras, the recitation of seven factors of enlightenment. But all these set of Bhojanga Sutras was also given by the Buddha to heal the sick monks. So we also chanted those sutras during that time. So we had a weekly chanting session. Every Friday evening, people will get together at their homes and we will open our Zoom. And they can see us, they can see the Buddha statue, they can see the other symbols. So then we will we chanted them those specific sutras focusing on healing and focusing on the protection from influences.
So I actually was going to ask you, I know that you went back to Sri Lanka in the last couple of years and you did a little bit of research on Buddhist responses to the pandemic in Sri Lanka. So I'm wondering if you can compare a little bit between what was happening at the Pittsburgh Buddhist Center and what was happening in Sri Lanka.
Yes, I think what was happening in the Buddhist Center, we had the facility, maybe facility to use online medium to reach people. But unfortunately, in Sri Lanka, the online platforms are not still well established. So one key difference would be that we use a lot of online programs, but in monks and in other Buddhist communities in Sri Lanka, they were not able to use that. But I think they use a lot of TV programs and radio programs. Yeah. But one common thing would be like how they made sense of this pandemic. You had to come up with an explanation, right? Not only scientific explanation, but you had to come with an explanation, maybe understanding why this global pandemic is here. And one common thing I saw is that many people tend to see that this pandemic is a result of the moral decline of human beings, and particularly violence to animals. And because human beings are killing so many animals these days without any care or any compassion. So this pandemic is a kind of result of that lack of compassion to animals, the consequences. Yeah.
So I'm not so familiar with Sri Lankan Buddhism. I know more about Thai and mainland Southeast Asian Buddhism. And in those parts of Asia, Theravada Buddhists tend not to be vegetarian. And I'm wondering, in Sri Lanka, is it the case that there's more emphasis on vegetarianism within Buddhism? Or is this something new that's coming because of the pandemic, this emphasis on animal violence?
Yeah, I mean, Sri Lankan Buddhists are also not necessarily vegetarian. Even monks are not necessarily vegetarians. But if someone is vegetarian, you consider him or her as a religious person. So nobody is imposing someone to become vegetarian, but if someone has selected, and usually the monks, so the vegetarianism will be like a mark of serious practitioners. But there's also a big difference between eating meat and eating fish. Because Sri Lanka being an island, there are a lot of fishing happening in Sri Lanka. So the eating fish and eating of meat is not considered the same level, but vegetarianism is revered, and and if someone is vegetarian, you consider him as a good Buddhist.
Yeah. So another thing I was wondering about is when you were talking about the initiatives at the Pittsburgh Buddhist Center, you were talking about a lot of them were more about social support and about providing community for people who were in need of community at that time. And I'm imagining that in Sri Lanka, where there are many more Buddhists than in Pittsburgh, that likely the temples were providing a great deal of those kinds of supports for the communities. And I'm wondering if that was something that you paid attention to when you were there.
Yeah, I mean, when I visited Sri Lanka, the pandemic was not that severe. The people are coming out of the pandemic during that time. But what I learned talking to people and doing some research is that they have also used the Buddhist communities, and particularly Buddhist temples, have used both the spiritual kind of healing and practices like chanting, and also some kind of social support, like preparing food for the affected families in the temples, and maybe collecting donation from the people to the temple and distributing it to the affected families. But I think the chanting, like those days, monks really started like chant sometime every day, every week. Sometimes they will chant and they will go around the village and sprinkle blessed water. And then of course the main the shrine in Sri Lanka, the temple of the tooth of the Buddha, they had week-long chanting ceremony. And then after the conclusion of the chanting, and they sprinkle the blessed water in the areas where the virus has spread a lot. So there were some areas that were lockdown areas. So they sprinkled this water in those areas. And also like simply the presence of the monks the sound of the chanting is also kind of helping and soothing to people, and it gives some kind of sense of refuge and security to people. But at the same time, there are also a lot of other social support groups. Particularly in Sri Lanka, if someone was tested positive in a household, and the government imposed that that house is quarantined, so that any member of that house cannot go out. But then how you survive? And we have to remember that there's no online ordering system in Sri Lanka. Of course, in Colombo and in city areas, we may have that, but not in villages. So if one house is quarantined and they have no way to, get their food, get their basic means, they cannot go out. So what I found is actually when one house is quarantined, the residents of that village organized themselves to take care of that family. So once your house is quarantined, they would keep a table in front of their house, and in front of their gate, actually. And then the villagers, they will volunteer to bring breakfast, lunch, and dinner to these people. So whoever bring breakfast will bring breakfast and keep that food on the table. And the people who volunteer to provide lunch would keep that lunch on the table. So those people, the residents will come out when there's nobody's there and take that food in. And they even don't know who actually kept that food for them. But then after 2 weeks, their quarantine period is over. They'll be recovered. And then if someone else got sick, in another house was quarantined, and they will be the part of the supporting system. So that's one way that they supported each other. But there are also big organizations who are distributing dry foods. Even the temples started to distribute dry foods. And particularly not only the people who are affected, who are actually tested positive, but also the people who lost their livelihood because nobody's traveling along the roads. And then the people who had daily wages, they had a lot of issues and problems too. So temples and Buddhist organizations collected funds and sometimes used whatever their existing funds and distributed dry food and everything. I also noticed that there were also people and some groups who are actually feeding stray dogs and stray cats. Because in Sri Lanka, we have a lot of stray dogs. And they don't belong to anyone, but they simply live in intersections along the roads, and they are by themselves, they have their own life. But they simply leave by leftover food by the shop, or in the shops, or maybe in the houses. So during this time, they were in big trouble because the people don't come to shops. There are no restaurants. People didn't come to restaurants. So I saw that some groups actually preparing food and going to all these different intersections and areas, and then distributing these foods to the stray cats and stray dogs.
Yeah, and that ties back to kindness towards animals, right? That was something you were talking yes, about earlier.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So what about meditation? Meditation as either a way of coping with the stress and the fear of the pandemic, but then also meditation maybe as a remedy or as a way of dealing with the infection of, with the virus itself? Was that a thing in Sri Lanka?
I noticed two main efforts made by monks and Buddhist groups that are related to meditation. One group actually started a program called Act of Truth. In Buddhist tradition, we have this practice called Satchakriya or Satyakriya, what you call Act of Truth. That if you follow a certain precepts, if you had a really good committed, religious practice, and then you can use that committed practice as a base to make an asseveration, make a resolution, make a command. So we call it Satchakriya, right? So there's one Buddhist organization, and they had big membership all over the country. So they contacted all their members. So they asked those members to follow precepts in certain days, extra precepts in certain days, and then come together at one time. All the group will get together at one time, and they will all sat down and do a deep meditation, and then they will all do what they call Act of Truth or Satchakriya, and they will make a wish or maybe command or resolution by the truthfulness of my practice, and may this pandemic be over and may the people get recovered. So it's a kind of a form of meditation, but more like a collective meditative effort that different people all over the country are doing same thing at the same time. The other effort was actually, as you mentioned, encouraging people to use meditation as a way of getting rid of the fear. And then also promoting mindfulness as a way of keeping one's hygiene, making sure that you don't unwittingly touch your face, and then making sure that you don't come closer to the other person, and making sure to keep your social distance. And then there are also monks who encourage people to, if you have a daily meditation practice, you will not be afraid of any sickness, and that, fearlessness will develop your immunity. So there was one monk who was actually promoting more committed meditation practice during the time of pandemic to stay fearless and stay safe. So those are the two main efforts I noticed, but there could have been many more.
Yeah, thank you. So I know that in Asia, there was a lot of interest in using traditional medicine for treatment or for prevention of COVID. And I'm wondering to what extent at the Pittsburgh Buddhist Center, you were able to acquire medicines or use any kind of traditional Ayurvedic medicines or other kinds of medicines from Asia for yourselves or for your community. Was that something that you were able to do or interested in doing?
Actually, we received a lot of herbal medicines from people, because as soon as this pandemic hit, many people were returning to their indigenous medicines, and many Sri Lankans living in the US started to send us the herbal drinks and many types of herbal drinks to keep our immunity strong. So we started drinking them. One common thing that we drank during that time was coriander, roasted coriander. But as a Buddhist center, we did not promote or distributed any herbs or any herbal drinks. I think I remember once, even we encourage even Americans to drink the boiled water of coriander. But we did not distribute any herbs or any medicine from the Buddhist center.
So is coriander water something that's very common in Sri Lanka when you become sick or?
Yeah, I mean, for any kind of respiratory problems, people will use coriander powder, coriander drinks in Sri Lanka. And it has been common for even well before the COVID. So once the COVID hit, actually many people started like drink more coriander. And then also they also start to use a lot of ginger. They will add ginger to coriander in a water and then they drink it. Yeah, it is a most common thing in Sri Lanka. Even like, you know, I remember that even when we got flu, any kind of that kind of flu related sickness, we used to drink coriander.
Hmm. I wish I knew that last week. I was very sick with the respiratory illness and I could have used some coriander.
You can try. You can try whether there's any effect on that.
I'm still recovering a little bit. My voice, I think, is a little bit scratchy still.
Yeah.
So I wanted to acknowledge the fact that Sri Lanka has been in a rather dire political and economic situation for the last couple of years following from the pandemic. And I think you were there at a particularly difficult time. And so I wanted to express my own good wishes for Sri Lankan people and for your family and for other people that are there. And I'm wondering if you can share with us how you see the current situation in Sri Lanka affecting people's relationship with Buddhism. Have the temples been instrumental in helping people to weather those storms?
Yeah, thank you for your concern and good wishes. You know, it's definitely, you know, many people in Sri Lanka is going through a really, really difficult time. And of course, COVID pandemic instigated this, you know, economic downturn. But I think even well before that, Sri Lanka didn't have a good, strong economy. Of course, people are going through a lot of difficulties. Many people are having issues even to like find their basic needs. And political situation is also not that stable. And I think the government is trying to get more help from IMF and other countries. So I don't know how successful they're going to be. But at the local level, the Buddhist organization, Buddhist groups are trying to help the local community. That is happening. That as far as my own temple is concerned, and I have been I have been collecting donations from people here. And then I'm sending donations to Sri Lanka to help school children to get their stationery and school bags for the new year. So that's one thing I know personally that I'm helping, and my master is also organizing a program to help pregnant mothers because when they are about to deliver, they need basic things to support the baby. And so my master is also organizing a program to distribute those items and requisites for pregnant mothers. So there are those small efforts happening in the around the temples and Buddhist organizations. But at the national level, I have no idea what kind of changes are occurring there.
Hmm.
But we'll be able to see in future.
Well, that's great. We'll definitely put links in the show notes so that listeners can make a contribution to some of those efforts that you're talking about. Thanks for mentioning that.
Sri Lanka is also, I mean, it used to be a good tourist destination. And then during pandemic, it lost its tourist population. That also impacted the economy, and particularly the flow of the foreign in currency. That impacted a lot too. Yeah.
So travel to Sri Lanka.
More people can, yeah, that will be one way to help. You know?
Yeah, Sri Lanka is a place that I've never been, but it's been a dream of mine to go there. So I'll have to do that soon to be able to support the economy.
Okay.
So, Venerable Pimaratna, I'm wondering if there's anything else that you want to talk about. Is there anything that we missed that I didn't think to ask you about, or any upcoming projects that you want to promote or discuss, or anything that you wanted to add before we close up?
Yeah, I think one thing I forgot to mention about what was happening in Sri Lanka is the efforts by local groups to experiment on different indigenous medicines. So of course, as I told you, during the pandemic, the people were more interested in indigenous medicine before the vaccine and even after the vaccine. And then there were national effort. You know, of course, the National Committee of Ayurvedic, you know, doctors, they produce a product, what they call immunity booster. So it was funded by the government, and they produce that boost. It's like a herbal drink, a mixture of a few ingredients in the herbal ingredients, and so then they release it to market. But at the same time, there were also local groups who are actually experimenting with different recipes and different herbal mix to treat people. So they will go to like infected families and they will give this drink and see whether there's an impact on them. So I came to know about few, you know, local groups who actually who are producing their own herbal drink and with their own recipes and then and helping the community. So that is one effort that was happening at the time in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think we've been hearing about similar experimentations all across Asia with all sorts of different traditional medicine, indigenous medicine recipes. And you know, I don't know how much formal research has been done everywhere, but some of them have been researched and have been shown to actually have some benefit. So that's a really interesting trend. I wonder if this whole pandemic is going to raise the profile of traditional medicines in Asia, like it locally.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. Yeah, it will, I think. People develop more trust in those medicines after they start to use them. So maybe we need to do more actual testings to really realize the actual effect of them. But I think in terms of the attitude, I think people have more trust in the indigenous and traditional medicines now.
Yeah, well, we'll see in the future. So you are a Buddhist monastic, you are a Dharma teacher, you have been leading a community through the pandemic and doing all of this observation in Sri Lanka. And I'm wondering if you can share with our listeners some Buddhist advice. What does Buddhism offer us in moments of fear and distress and illness and mass death, like the COVID-19 pandemic? What resources can we draw from Buddhism if we are not already Buddhist? Is that a fair question?
Yes. I'm just thinking, you know, what Buddhism can offer to people who are not necessarily Buddhist. One remedy, maybe one resource that Buddhism can offer would be like how we can use our mind to overcome our physical illnesses and diseases. And of course, during this kind of pandemic, we are definitely stressed, we are definitely fearful, and when we get sick, definitely, and we are also weak physically. But I think one thing that Buddhism can offer is that how, even though our body is sick, even though our society is in danger, or maybe society is in disorder, we can still use our mind. And that's the one thing that we can have some control. So with regard to our body, we have less control. With regard to our natural environment, we can influence it a lot, but we have less control of the natural system. But I think the area that we have some control, area that we can do something, is our mind, which is not even is still easy. So, but I think that will be the message that Buddha can offer, that if we pay attention to our own mind, and if we keep our mind with some positive thoughts, for example, you would be grateful to whatever you have, you know, although you have lost so many things, although you are going through such a difficult time, but there can be so many other things that you are still having. And so be developing some kind of gratitude towards the life, towards everyone, and then also developing some empathy with the other suffering people and loving kindness, and developing all these wholesome thoughts can be a healing factor to our own body. And then such thoughts will also gradually help us to heal the larger community too. So because we have empathy and compassion, we will try our best not to increase that pain or suffering. We will be careful not to be a spreader of the virus, or maybe not to contribute in any way to increase the pandemic situation. So that will be one thing that Buddhism will be able to offer, like showing that how we can look at our own mind and maybe train it a little bit and maybe navigate our mind and try our best to like pay attention to things that are hidden from us and pay attention to our own things that we can be grateful for, and also to pay attention to the suffering of others and developing empathy and compassion. And so once you have the compassion and for the pain of the others, and it gives you kind of capacity to endure that pain, but at the same time do something to alleviate that pain. So by changing the mind, we will be able to, you know, change the body and change the society, definitely. So by first taking care of the mind, you can heal the body and then gradually heal the community around you.
Beautiful. Yeah, thank you so much. That's a great place for us to wrap up our conversation, a great final thought to leave people with. So thank you for that. And thank you so much for being with us today.
And yeah, and thank you. Thank you very much for this invitation. I really enjoyed this conversation and reflecting on the things. And I mean, reflecting on the difficult times that we had, and then now we can enjoy talking about it, right? When we were going through that difficult time, it was not fun, but now looking back at them is a learning experience, and it's a joyful thing. So thank you very much for allowing that opportunity for me and for many others to look back our difficult times and be happy about how we spend that time.
Yeah, great. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you so much.
Yes. Bhavatu sabbe mangalam, rakkantu sabbe devata, sabba buddhanu bhavena sada sotanti bhavantu te, bhavatu sabba mangalam, rakkantu sabba devata, sabba dhammanu bhavena sada sotanti bhavantu te, bhavatu sabba mangalam, rakkantu sabba devata, sabba sanghanu bhavena sada sotanti bhavantu te.
May all beings be happy.
Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you for that blessing.
Most welcome. Yeah.
That is it for today from us at the Blue Barrel Podcast. This episode was hosted by Pierce Alguero and produced and edited by me, Lan Lee. All of our music is by Jonathan Pettit. If you're listening to us on one of our partner podcasts, make sure to catch all of our episodes on piercealguero.com or subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. You can also support us by making a donation at patreon.com/bluebarrel. Until next time, be happy and be well.